Today is April 6th, Army Day, 1948. From the steps of Kalamazoo County Building in Kalamazoo, Michigan, the Fetzer Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with the United States Army, is proud to present a special program honoring Army Day in Kalamazoo. Since 1927, Army Day has become a traditional celebration throughout the United States. However, it was not until 1937 that Congress and the President of the United States officially proclaimed April 6th of each year as Army Day, a day during which military establishments in every part of this great nation would assist civic groups in appropriate demonstrations. This day is set aside each year for the nation to remember the courage and heroism of the American soldier. The first speaker on this evening's program will be Mr. James M. Wilson, winner of the Distinguished Service Cross during World War I as a second lieutenant in Europe, and now a member of the Civilian Advisory Committee of Kalamazoo. Mr. Wilson.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to welcome this fine crowd to this Army Day celebration. We see the National Guard of Michigan airplanes flying overhead. And this Army Day celebration is being participated in by our Kalamazoo National Guard Company C of the 126th Infantry, the Organized Reserve, and the Veterans Organizations of Kalamazoo. Music for the celebration is by the Eagles Band. This time I take pleasure in introducing to you the mayor of Kalamazoo, the Honorable Henry Ford.
Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, the people of Kalamazoo are joining the people of the entire nation today in paying tribute to the men and women now serving in the United States Army, and to express our appreciation to the former members of the Army for their heroism, their sacrifice, and their devotion, which brought our nation through the recent war victorious. First of all, we, the people of Kalamazoo, should pay our respects to our Kalamazoo men and women, who, as a result of their service in the Army, made the supreme sacrifice. It is difficult for us to adequately express our appreciation for what they gave in behalf of our country. They died so that others might live, that others might continue to live in the land of their choice as free men and women, that others might enjoy freedom of speech, freedom from want, freedom of religion, freedom from fear, and all those blessings that the citizens of a democracy can enjoy. They did not want to die, but they had a duty to perform, and they performed it, even though it meant their death. Because of the sacrifice they made, we who remain here to enjoy the things they saved for us likewise have a duty to perform. That duty is to see that they did not make that sacrifice in vain. There's always a danger in peacetime as well as in war that our rights as American citizens may be taken from us, that the form of government we enjoy and for which we fought might be so changed by the influence of enemies within our country as well as outside our territorial limits that the liberty of our people might be destroyed. So let us be ever watchful for any danger that threatens the freedom of our land and might undo the things that they accomplished. There are others that served in the Army that we must not forget. There are the thousands who, while not giving their lives, gave their chance for good health and for freedom of action. We'll never be able to compensate our disabled veterans for the sacrifice they have made. Modern science is doing a great deal toward their rehabilitation, but it's a duty for all of us to do everything we can to help them have a happy and a full life. Then, let us on this Army Day in 1948 remember the service which has been rendered by all men and women of the United States Army. They not only gave their time, most of them suffered hardships that are known only to war. Today, we express our appreciation to all of them, from buck private to general. And on Army Day, we should attempt to understand and know the Army better. I think that we're too prone to think of war when we think of the Army. We shrink from thinking about war because war calls to our minds destruction, death, and hardship. Yet these are not the things for which the Army stands. Rather, it stands for the preservation of democracy, for the safeguarding of the homes and the lives of our citizens, for the maintenance of peace. The destruction wrought by our Army was only a necessary means under the circumstances existing for the achievement of the goal we sought. The Army of the United States is one of the greatest branches of our government. It has made great contributions to the development of our country and its resources. Our Army has built railroads, great highways, government buildings, canals, and bridges. Through its medical department, it has developed means of curing diseases thought to be incurable. And when disaster is struck in peacetime, in the form of fires, floods, and storms, the Army has taken over where civilian governmental units have not had the facilities. Even today, the United States Army is engaged through its engineer's office in making a flood control survey, which will be of great benefit to the people of Kalamazoo. The weapons and the equipment the Army has developed for war are adaptable in industry and agriculture. And with the aid of civilians, the Army helped develop the atomic bomb. And now atomic energy will be harnessed and developed for industrial and scientific purposes. So, ladies and gentlemen, our American life has been broadened and made more abundant by the services of the Army in peacetime. It serves our country in peace as well as in war. Right now, our government is in the process of strengthening our peacetime Army. Plans are being discussed for the reestablishment of the Selective Service System. And Congress has before it now the problem of whether or not to adopt a law requiring universal military training. I think regardless of how our people may differ on the question of universal military training, we're all agreed that preparedness is a virtue and that a strong Army is a necessity in these days of international tension. So let us honor the Army today, not only for the part that it's played in the past, but for the service it will render in the future. And now, ladies and gentlemen, it is a pleasure for me to introduce the principal speaker of this Army Day program. Our speaker is well known to the people of Kalamazoo and to our radio audience. For many years, he was professor of history at Kalamazoo College and dean of that school. Since 1944, he has been program director for station WKZO. His programs as a commentator have become very popular with radio audiences in this community. And I take great pleasure at this time in presenting to you Dr. Willis F. Dunbar. Dr. Dunbar.
Mr. Chairman, Mayor Ford, fellow citizens of Kalamazoo, Army Day 1948 comes at a time when we are keenly aware of a world situation which leaves us no alternative but to strengthen our national defense. We had hoped that the United Nations organization might be able to provide the means by which international problems could be solved and differences composed. We had hoped that through a world court and a world police force, collective security might be provided for our own nation as well as other nations. But as we all know, the conflict of interest between our country and the Soviet Union, their growing distrust of each other, and mounting suspicion one of the other, have created a situation in which the United Nations organization is unable to provide for the general security. In the future, the high hopes which we all had for the United Nations idea may be realized. The charter of the organization may be amended, if necessary, to enable it to fulfill its purposes. For assuredly, in the long run, the only real hope for world peace lies in such an organization. There can be no permanent peace until we can agree to abide by the decisions of a world assembly and a world court, and to permit those decisions to be enforced by a world police force. In the meantime, we have no recourse but to take every measure necessary to the defense of our own country. We have learned by bitter experience that if we allow any strong world power to extend itself and destroy the independence of other nations, that power will sooner or later get around to us. Hence, it's our concern in defending the United States when any nation sets out on a career of expansion. We must also be concerned when a political party in our own or any other country is shown to be the stooge of some ambitious foreign power. To defend ourselves, we must make common cause with others in the defense of freedom all over the globe. There is no other way. The United States has never been a militaristic nation. The men who framed the Constitution of the United States and established our government were keenly aware of the danger which militarism poses to a free people. They read and pondered history, these forefathers of ours. They knew that the Roman Republic in ancient times, one of the greatest experiments in free government, went down before the assaults of a militaristic clique. Accordingly, they put in the Constitution a provision which made the President of the United States a civilian, Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy. They provided that Army appropriations were to be for a period of no longer than 2 years. They provided for militias in the state instead of one national army. In these and many other ways, they recognized the danger of militarism to the people. Down through the years, our country has never maintained a large standing army. We have entered every war in which we have engaged unprepared. Yet we have won every one of those wars. We have been able to do so for one very simple reason. The location of our nation, separated from Europe by one ocean and from Asia by another, has in the past made us invulnerable to immediate attack. Hence, we've had time to raise and train armies after war was declared. That has saved us in every instance. But we face a different situation today. The development of long-range aircraft and guided missiles makes our country today vulnerable to attack from the outset. If we were attacked now and had not taken prudent measures for our defense prior to the attack, then we would be faced with an impossible task. We would have to get our war production going, train and equip our manpower while under attack by the enemy. We thus face a serious dilemma. If we go all out for militarism, we open ourselves to the threat of militarist domination, an eventuality which the wise founders of this republic foresaw and sought to guard against. If we do not keep our military strength at a high level, then we open ourselves to attack by some foreign power, which we might not be able to repel. We must not blind ourselves to either danger. At the same time, we must act. The wise course, it seems to me, is to provide for the present exigency without committing ourselves to a permanent military establishment, which at some future time might destroy our freedom. If our relations with the Soviet Union continue to degenerate, and if we are unable to find peaceful solutions to our problems, if the Russians continue to be unimpressed by our determination to defend ourselves and the cause of freedom as we conceive it, then we may have war. If we have properly provided for our military needs, we shall win that war. And we can then proceed to work through the United Nations to set up in this world a workable system of collective security. If, on the other hand, the Russians should come to their senses, and if the present hysteria in this country abates to the point where negotiation is possible, the suspicions and hatreds which are at present at such a high point on both sides may slowly abate. When and if that should happen, the United Nations could begin to operate as it was intended. Whichever way it may go, we shall need, in the next 10 or a dozen years, a strong and mighty Army, Navy, and Air Force. At the same time, we must never forget that permanently such a predominant military power is a potential menace to both ourselves and others. And we must continue to seek ways and means of finding a way to safeguard our country by other means. Such a program as I have outlined places heavy responsibilities both upon the Army and upon you and me as citizens. We shall have to trust the Army to promote the development of modern scientific weapons, to encourage that same inventive genius as regards our military arm that has made America so strong in other ways. We shall have to trust our Army leadership in terms of their ultimate aims and objectives. We shall have to assume that when they ask for men, they need men for the defense of the United States and not for indoctrination alone. We shall have to assume that when the Army asks Congress for money, that money is needed and that it will be spent prudently. It is not the business of the Army to determine the foreign policy of the United States, nor should any information be withheld by the Army from the American people.